You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 69 of the Fabulous Pelton
Nice. Cast.
I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we have so much to get to this week.
We really do.
We have got Isaiah Thomas discussion / breakdown. The final first round matchup in Seattle's, in the Pelton Cast search for Seattle's best burger. We have got sports news from the Sounders, big news from the Sounders, plus a special guest with us to discuss Mariners hot takes and a thorough Seahawks preseason breakdown.
I like how you said that, as if the name of the special guest isn't right there in the heading of the podcast.
Yes, or the only reason you're listening to this podcast.
And if so, welcome. We're going to get started. As usual this week, we're drinking through the Sierra Nevada Beer Camp Across the World series. And what do we have this week?
And what we have here is a dry-hopped Berliner-style Weiss, brewed in partnership with Texas's St. Arnold Brewery.
Okay, that sounds good. I wanted to propose a toast this week as we start off this podcast to someone who has provided us a lot of information as Seahawks beat writer for ESPN.com, to Sheil Kapadia, who announced today on Twitter that tomorrow will be his last day on the Seahawks beat and at ESPN as he moves on to pursue new opportunities.
Wow. A toast to Sheil, also pouring one out.
Yeah, I mean, it's disappointing. He's done a phenomenal job. We knew that he would, based on his work covering the Eagles and doing a lot of film analysis and breakdown in Philadelphia before he got hired by ESPN. So as soon as he was hired, I made sure to reach out, wanted to make him feel welcomed at ESPN in Seattle, and he's done a terrific job, has lived up to those high expectations.
You're going
to
hate this beer.
Oh, it's very sour?
Yes, it's very sour. And
Oh, no.
Fortunately, on Sheil's second to last day, the Seahawks acquiring a player from the Eagles.
That's true.
Giving him one extra thing to talk about.
Where should we get started?
Well, I think we should start with this 4-5 burger matchup that we've been waiting so long for.
All right. Well, now it's time for our final quarterfinal in the search for Seattle's best burger. And who do we have joining us as a third Pelton brother today?
We have coming from Barsook Records, somebody who I would consider a burger expert, from what I've heard, has done a lot of training for this particular matchup. We have Jim Petosa.
Yes, hello. Hello, gentlemen.
Jim, we're so excited to have you here for what I consider maybe the most contested matchup of the first round of our burger bracket. Do you want to start things off by giving us some of your burger credentials?
Uh-oh, you guys cut out.
Okay.
That's okay. Now
it records locally, so yeah.
Okay, good. So my burger expertise starts with Jack in the Box ultimate cheeseburgers, only mayo and cheese is how I order it.
Is this pre E. coli?
No, this is after E. coli. That's when it's the safest to eat a burger.
That is true. That is very true.
Plus the lines are a lot shorter. And I guess that's the extent of my burger expertise. Does that disqualify me?
No, that's great. Jack in the Box makes a very delicious burger.
Well, if that was literally the only burger you'd ever eat,
yeah, is that the only one?
That's it. Yeah, it's the only one.
Well, this must have been a whole new world for you.
The experience for this podcast didn't call for much.
So we are matching in this last quarterfinal the 4 seed and the 5 seed, and I can't really remember which is which because I think I've said both ways, Red Bull Burgers and Unita Burger. What did you think visiting these two locations?
Well, kudos to both of you for picking maybe the two most expensive burger places in Seattle. Appreciate that.
You could have gone to 8 Ounce. That would have been more expensive.
Palace Kitchen.
Red Mill was very good. And if I may declare the winner.
Oh, you're going right into a winner.
Wow. Was this your first time at Red Mill?
No, it's my second time, but it was my first time at Unita Burger.
Really? I would have guessed that you were more of a burger about town kind of person.
How many times do you think I go get burgers a week?
Most people don't do it 2 or 3 times a week like we have been.
You have some preconceived notions of my burger eating.
Okay, so you're going with Red Mill. What did you get there?
I got the bacon and blue burger, which was excellent, I must say.
And so that's bacon and blue cheese?
Yes.
I've never ventured that far outside the standard burgers at Red Mill. Have you, Tristan?
No, mostly just deluxe. Deluxe with cheese, double deluxe.
Are you guys more of a standard burger men, or do you not go for the specialties?
I think it depends on the place, but I feel like I'm pretty interested in the standard burger.
Yeah, and I would say generally the same.
Do you get ketchup on your burger?
Ketchup, and if there's a secret sauce.
Okay, all right.
What did you go with at Unita Burger?
Well, I didn't want to skew the results, so I got another blue cheeseburger.
Nice.
This one had watercress, which I had to Google what watercress was.
And, what did you come up with?
it's a leafy substance.
That sounds right.
Yeah, it's green and caramelized onions.
What stood out? Was there something missing about the Unita Burger, or what stood out that made Red Mill better for you?
I think the Unita Burger one, the Red Mill, it was saltier, which I think at my age now, being in my 30s and doing the damage to my taste buds that I have, I need as much pepper and salt as possible. and it was a cleaner burger. I don't know about you, but I don't like it when it's like wet and falling apart like Unita Burger was.
Unita Burger was falling apart. Interesting.
Yeah, it was.
Well, right. I think we had a very different experience at Unita Burger versus Red Mill.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So
what burger did you guys get?
We went to both of these locations tonight. At Unita, we split two classics, one of them with bacon, one of them with cheddar cheese. And then at Red Mill, I went with my standard order, which is just a plain cheeseburger at Red Mill. I go very basic there. And then you had the deluxe. Did not have bacon on yours, did you, Tristan?
No, no bacon this time. Although, when you see the mountain of bacon that Red Mill has, it's hard to avoid.
It's a sight to behold. So I went into this probably leaning towards Unita Burger. I thought that, you know, when we went through our original round of reviews, that Unita, which is interesting, so I'd only been there once before, and I had actually not enjoyed my burger at Unita very much. I can't remember what I got, but, you know, maybe I went too exotic. Maybe I had something with watercress, although I don't think so because I haven't looked that up. But when we went during the opening round, I thought it was really right there in a tier with Lil Woody's, is, you know, two of the three best burgers in Seattle, probably. At least two of the best four. And I would say that opinion was reconfirmed by the burgers that we had tonight.
And so what are you going with?
So I am going with Unita. I mean, I think Red Mill is terrific. There was a time in my life where I think I would have said that Red Mill was my favorite burger in Seattle when I was working at the Seattle Storm offices nearby and going there at least probably once a month at that point. And, you know, the special sauce that they have has a nice little bit of a kick to it. I'm a big fan of that, which you didn't get trying the bacon and blue burger. But nonetheless, Unita, the quality of the patty, very juicy patty, and then the way that the mayo and the lettuce, the chopped lettuce kind of interact, that to me is a great flavor combination. So it's Unita for me. That makes you the deciding vote, Tristan.
When I went into this, probably leaning toward Red Mill. I think there is a time where I thought that Red Mill might have been maybe the number one burger in Seattle. And I left this matchup thinking that we have a serious competitor to the number one seed, Loretta's.
Wow.
And that competitor is not Red Mill this time, unfortunately. Having that burger at Unita, it was so thick and juicy. The burger was excellent. The lettuce was excellent. The tomato was perfect. The cheese that we had on it. The whole coterie of dipping options, having those available, it was just too much. And I have a bit of a confession to make about my Red Mill burger.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I gave it the best shake, to be honest. I'm not sure if I gave it a fair shake because I ate it while driving. We were driving back and I had about a third left of the burger. And this is my confession because I may have broken the law here. I threw it out the window.
No, why would you do that? Where were you at when you did this?
I don't want to say exactly because I could be found out.
Statute of limitations.
If somebody finds a burger, they'll know who did it.
Wow, I can't believe that.
So I'm sorry, Jim, but we both went Unita for this round.
Wow, this is surprising.
Yeah, this is the
Why'd
first
you
time.
Have me on?
we did not know beforehand.
This yourselves.
Did you eat both of the burgers in the same day?
No. That sounds horrible.
Yeah, it really was.
I'm feeling it a little bit. Because I didn't throw out the final third of my Red Mill burger. I finished it. I mean, I would say that, you know, we didn't have the best Red Mill experience because of the fact that we were in a hurry. But it's not like I need to, like, really sample Red Mill to know what it's like. I know what Red Mill is like. I've had a dozen Red Mill burgers or more in my lifetime. I got it. So I feel like I gave it a fair shake.
Have you been to Loretta's, Jim?
No, I have not.
I don't know. I mean, if you've only had Jack in the Box burgers before this, I think you might like the burger. But also, just as a bar, it's pretty much the number one bar in Seattle.
You know, I thought about going there after I saw the bracket, and I guess I'm going to have to if it wins.
Oh, only if it wins.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting closer. We're getting closer to finding out now that we have the semifinal matchups are set, the final four in our search for Seattle's best burger. It will be the number one seed Loretta's against the number four or five seed Unitaburger.
We may have had an upset. We may not have.
And then on the other side of the bracket, Chalk over there, number two seed Little Woody's versus number three seed Dick's. And we will be deciding both of these matchups next week when I think we're going to have a pair of Third Belton Brothers.
That's right. We're eating straight through four burgers in one day.
Yeah. Possibly a third indoor fourth Belton Brother, I guess, at that point, if we have two of them on the same podcast. But stay tuned for that. And of course, 2 weeks away from crowning Seattle's best burger at our live show. So it's a very exciting time in our burger search. And thanks so much, Jim, for participating and helping us. Well, in this case, actually not helping us.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Oh, potentially, man. Helping us.
Anytime, guys.
Make this decision. All right. The Burger Final Four is set. Time to talk about basketball?
So much basketball to talk about.
It was a stunningly big day in the NBA for being August 22nd. As the Cleveland Cavaliers and Boston Celtics come together on a blockbuster trade, sending Kyrie Irving, who had requested a trade from the Cavaliers to the Celtics, in exchange for Tacoma's own Isaiah Thomas, along with Jay Crowder, rookie center Ante Zizic, and the Brooklyn Nets 2018 first round.
Huge news. News so big it sparked you to put on your Isaiah Thomas Washington Husky jersey.
I'm wearing it while we record this very podcast, in fact. Yeah, I mean, I didn't see this coming. I got to be honest with you. My take on the Celtics' possibility for Kyrie Irving is that it just didn't make sense because of the fact that, you know, they would have to give up such important parts of their current roster and indeed, you know, trade two starters for Kyrie Irving and now have lost four of their five starters and five of the seven players who played the most minutes on last year's Eastern Conference Finals team.
So before we get excited about Isaiah being on the Cavs, let's talk about this trade basically from both sides. What is the purpose of doing this if you're Boston?
Well, I think...
What grade did you give it?
I gave the Celtics a C and I gave the Cavaliers an A. So, and you can check out those grades, of course, on ESPN Insider. From the Boston standpoint, I mean, why do you do this trade? Because of the fact that Kyrie is, you know, 3 years younger than Isaiah, who's going to turn 29 next season. He's got an additional year left on his contract, and he is bigger and therefore has the potential to be a better defender.
Has he been a better defender?
He's probably been a better defender over the course of his career than Isaiah was last season. I think before last season, Isaiah was the better of the two players defensively.
Wow.
In the regular season, but what we've seen, most notably in the 2016 NBA Finals against the Golden State Warriors, and in Game 1 the previous year before Kyrie was injured, is, you know, because he's got the physical tools to be a capable defender, when his effort level is there in that final setting, he has held his own defensively, and that's something that...
So all Boston needs to do is get to the finals, and then he'll play defense.
Well, I mean, realistically, you look at the Eastern Conference, if LeBron James...
You've got IT waiting for you.
If LeBron James leaves Cleveland after this season, then the path could be very clear for the Boston Celtics to go to the NBA Finals. But it's interesting. I mean, this is a team that's had a lot of success against the Warriors the last couple of years, but now has just completely changed that lineup. You know, it was relying heavily on Avery Bradley, who has already been traded to the Detroit Pistons. It was relying on Crowder, who now will be playing against them in Cleveland.
So are the Celtics even a good defensive team anymore?
I mean, they weren't, frankly, that good of a defensive team last season. You know, they're counting really on Jaylen Brown to step into this role.
What did they do last season? They were good at offense when Isaiah was on the court.
Yes.
What else did they do?
I mean, they weren't bad defensively, but they had been really good defensively a couple of years ago, and you know they were not that last season.
Okay, so what about for Cleveland?
Well, obviously Kyrie Irving had requested a trade, so they wanted to accommodate that. It seemed like we had probably passed the point of no return in terms of Kyrie continuing to play in Cleveland, you know, based on the idea that he wanted to leave the shadow of LeBron James and play a larger role. I mean, it seemed like reconciliation with LeBron and with the Cavaliers was probably not going to be possible. So, you know, in that context, I don't think they were going to get probably a better package in terms of helping them beat the Golden State Warriors this season. And then they also get that Brooklyn pick. So, you know, if LeBron walks away in a year, all of a sudden you're looking at a lottery pick to jumpstart your rebuilding process.
I mean, to me, it sets them up so well, both for next year and then for the future, right?
Right.
A lot of people have been saying...
Which are the only two things. There's next year and then the future.
A lot of people have been rationalizing this, cough Celtics fans, by saying that Brooklyn is going to be pretty good next year.
They're going to be more competitive next season. I don't think I would go so far as to say they're going to be pretty good.
Where would you project them?
Well, they are. In fact, we have the ESPN Real Plus Minus projections that came out earlier this month that had them in the bottom five in the NBA.
Okay. So what this means is they have 1 year of LeBron, 1 year of Isaiah together with Jay Crowder all of a sudden, who's a good player matching up against Golden State, right?
Yeah, he's essentially like a souped up version of what Richard Jefferson did for them in the 2016 final.
He's Richard Jefferson, but not 40 years old.
Jefferson would be the first to point out to you that he's not quite 40 yet.
Okay. So they're set up for next year. And then if LeBron is to walk, they can just let Isaiah go and then start rebuilding with that pick.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really a pretty ideal trade for them. And I mean, you know, it's interesting, the idea that obviously it's unclear how willing the Celtics were to include Brooklyn picks in these past trades for Jimmy Butler and Paul George. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen. And now all of a sudden they are including that pick.
So when you think about the packages that they could have gotten before, right, that they could have given up for somebody like Paul George, for somebody like Jimmy Butler, do you think this makes sense?
Well, you know, I think first off, all indications, you know, Woj reported that they're confident they can re-sign Kyrie Irving. And that's the critical factor here is, you know, you can't make this trade just for 2 years of Kyrie Irving. It's way too much to give up years for Kyrie Irving. If you're getting 6 or 7 years of Kyrie Irving, all of a sudden it becomes a lot more tenable of a trade for them to make. So, you know, whether Jimmy Butler would have re-signed was a question mark, and Paul George was beyond a question mark, was, you know, even probably an unlikely player to
we'll see now.
With them.
Who knows now?
Oh, because of the tampering charges?
Yes.
I'd be really surprised if they were prevented from signing him. And I think Paul George would go somewhere else. Well, maybe not as compared to Boston,
Okay, so then most importantly, how excited are we that Isaiah is not on the Celtics anymore?
Well,
I mean, like, if there's one team that I felt more uncomfortable cheering for, there's only one, literally one team that I just wouldn't have cheered for if Isaiah was on them, right? Number two is Boston.
I mean, I've said before, the way that Celtics fans embraced Isaiah Thomas as one of their own, you know, made me feel a lot better about Celtics fans.
Good for them. Good for you also. There's no city that deserved Isaiah Thomas less, that deserved success so quickly after being good, less than the city of Boston.
I mean, look, they've gone through hardships. I think the Red Sox didn't make the playoffs 1 year.
I think they've...
That's true, right?
They've gone, I think, back and forth going to the playoffs. Yeah. But no, they've definitely seen hard times. And now we get to see Isaiah Thomas playing with LeBron James.
That's going to be fascinating to watch. You know, what's interesting about this is obviously the fact that Isaiah and Kyrie are such similar players stylistically.
Who's a better scorer?
Last season, Isaiah was the better scorer. He both used a higher percentage of his team's plays and was more efficient last season.
I mean, Isaiah, watching those playoffs with the Celtics, when Isaiah was on the court, they were much better, right?
No, actually, they were much worse with Isaiah on the court.
Okay, so throughout the season, they were much better when he was on the court.
That is accurate.
But in the playoffs, he had a hard time getting open shots.
It was much more of a challenge for him.
Now he's playing with LeBron James.
And Kevin Love.
I
mean, you know, frankly, with all due respect to Al Horford, Kevin Love's better offensive player, I think, than any other Celtic besides Isaiah last year.
Imagine the lineup of LeBron, Jay Crowder, Kevin Love, Isaiah. And right.
We'll imagine. So let's say they put JR, they put Love at the five and have JR Smith as the fifth player out there.
They could spread the court so well and play defense. I mean,
They could play better defense than they were before because now you've got Jay Crowder in that spot.
Yes. Oh, I'm so excited about this. I can't wait for Isaiah to be on Cleveland.
So I think the interesting question to me is Isaiah Thomas better off after this trade?
Okay.
So I think the plus is, you know, oh yeah, he gets the chance to play with LeBron James.
Yes.
Gets the chance to play on an even more marquee team than he was already on, which was pretty marquee. I mean, with Gordon Hayward coming in, you would figure that his role was going to be a little bit reduced next year in Boston. And it will certainly still be somewhat reduced in Cleveland, but I think actually his role might be somewhat larger with the Cavaliers than it would have been with the Celtics, which is a little hard to believe.
Wow. Do you think he's going to do more spot-up shooting with Cleveland?
Yeah, I think he unquestionably will. Like I was saying, you know, I think Gordon Hayward was going to run a lot of pick and roll, so that was going to be more a part of his game. But yes, I think he'll still do more of it in Cleveland. The interesting question is, so let's say that LeBron does leave and the Cavs do decide to rebuild. If they aren't bidding for Isaiah Thomas's services, using his bird rights, it gets a little difficult to see where exactly a large offer is going to come for him in free agency. There's not a lot of teams who have max level cap space in 2018, and you know, most of the teams that do are teams that are in some stage of rebuilding right now. You know, Chicago has a lot of cap space next summer. Indiana has a lot of cap space. You know, Philadelphia probably will, but they're certainly not looking for a point guard after drafting Markelle Fultz. Atlanta probably not in the market for a point guard, so you know, it might get a little tricky for him if LeBron leaves. That's where I think the biggest potential downside, whereas Boston was going to have no way to replace him in free agency unless they had drafted a point guard with one of the picks they had coming. They were probably going to be obligated to re-sign Isaiah Thomas. So
I mean, it's kind of, Isaiah's always been in an uncomfortable situation, right? And this just feels like more the same. He's a player who nobody will admit is a star. This has been that way his entire career.
I think people have admitted he's a star. He was second team All-NBA.
Even now, people are treating it as though Kyrie is so much better than Isaiah Thomas, whereas statistically this last season, who is a better player?
Oh, Isaiah.
They still treat it like Kyrie is a better player on the court because they can't get past the fact that he's short, or they can't get past the fact that he was the last pick in the draft.
I mean,
right?
Kyrie is the more valuable playoff player. And
across the board, though, Kyrie, he went to Duke. He's taller. He was the first pick in the draft. Isaiah Thomas is from the far side of the country where nobody looks for him. He's this tiny player, always an underdog. And even still, you're saying going into free agency, that'll be the case. He's an older point guard that people can't find a spot for.
I'm saying it's less about Isaiah Thomas and more about the fact that next summer's free agency is going to be bad for almost all but the elite free agents. And specifically for guys at point guard, it does not seem, unless, you know, Chicago decides to pivot and try to compete and Chris Dunn is a disappointment next year, then okay. Or Indiana decides to compete. Like, if one of those two teams are interested, then they have tremendous needs at point guard. But if those rebuilding teams aren't interested in a 29-year-old point guard, which seems like a likely scenario, there's just not that many teams that have cap space. Now, maybe someone will create it between now and then. Maybe someone will figure a way to do a sign-in trade. But it's a more challenging scenario for Isaiah in terms of his free agency than it was 24 hours ago.
So what you're saying is we should appreciate this next year of Isaiah Thomas?
I'm saying Isaiah Thomas should appreciate this next year of Isaiah Thomas.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, well, we're definitely going to. I mean, I was already a Cleveland fan, and them adding Isaiah Thomas is great.
Should we talk about Key Arena?
Yeah, so was there new news this week?
I mean, there wasn't any specifically arena-related news, but a piece of local transportation news that certainly impacts the question of where, you know, Seattle is going to build a new NBA NHL arena, and that's the Port of Seattle contributing an extra $10 million in funding on top of the $5 million they had already promised toward the overpass on Lander Street across the train tracks there, giving the city enough money to fund that project now that they have reduced the projected cost of it. And the reason why this is relevant to the arena debate is because part of what Chris Hansen's group had proposed as part of building an arena in the SoDo area is that they would step up and complete that funding to get this project built.
Okay.
So taking that off the table, not coincidentally, the Port of Seattle being one of the biggest critics of the idea of building another arena in the SoTo area, removes, I think, some of the incentive to accept that offer from Chris Hansen's group.
Yeah, so it's so a bad what does this mean for the SoTo proposal?
It's weird because on a strictly technical level, so what this proposal is also going to do is it's going to dead end the alley Occidental Avenue that Chris Hansen has asked to have vacated so that they can build the arena over that street because of the fact that the land they owned is on either side of that alley. So like from a strictly technical standpoint, it should make the street vacation much more of a no-brainer. But obviously the street vacation isn't actually about the street, as Jeff Baker elucidated in a Seattle Times article that made the case in favor of the street vacation not actually being about the vacation of the street. And that's why it was voted down 5-4 when Chris Hansen's group brought this request last year.
Because they're not concerned with actually vacating the street.
No, it obviously has no value as a street. Not no value. No value is unfair, but it has very limited value.
I mean, I'm going to go to that street and tell it that you said that.
I don't want to pull a Nick Licata and use hyperbole when it's inappropriate here. It has limited value from a transportation standpoint. That the value of it from a transportation standpoint is not a reason to oppose the vacation of that street. It's clearly just about whether you want an arena built in that location. So again, this takes away one of the carrots that Chris Hansen's group was able to offer the city. And I think it's the latest indication that it all things are moving along towards the Key Arena renovation at this point.
Is SoTo dead? Can you say that right now?
No, and that's what the thrust of Jeff Baker's article was last week, that it's not dead. And we still have to see where the final negotiations land between the city and the Oakview group on, you know, what the actual deal to renovate Key Arena is going to look like. That's the million-dollar question here. But again, I would say that just every indicator that's been out there the last couple of months has pointed towards this Key Arena deal getting done.
Okay, so anything else on arena news?
Well, should we talk about, speaking of Key Arena,
things that actually happened at the arena?
Things
that
actually happened at the arena. Men's professional basketball happened at Key Arena for, you know, depending on how you count, I don't know if I'm the only one who recalls the 3BA, a previous incarnation of 3-on-3 basketball, but that wasn't really professional.
You would be one of the world's foremost experts on the 3BA.
You're damn right.
What was that, trampoline basketball?
That was not trampoline. No, it was 3-on-3 full court.
But what was that trampoline basketball called?
That was slam ball.
Oh, slam ball.
Slam ball did not ever get played at Key Arena, sadly. The Big Three making its appearance at Key Arena last weekend. If you haven't already, please check out the interview that we did with Rashard Lewis to preview his return to Seattle and go back through his Sonics career, some of the high points, even some of the low points. And, you know, really, I thought Rashard was tremendously candid.
That was awesome.
I enjoyed that interview so much. It was one of the favorite, legitimately one of the favorite interviews I've ever done in my sports career.
Wow.
I would go that far as to say it. So then, you know, Rashard's team, the three-headed monsters, kind of the marquee game of the day in the Big Three playoffs, playing for a spot in the championship next Saturday in Las Vegas, and a close game throughout. It was tied at 46. Rashard had kind of struggled. He'd been double teamed often. He was taking the ball out of his hands. He
double teamed in a 3-on-3 game?
Yeah. Yeah, which, you know, he told us that you don't see as much, but in this case, they were willing to, the Power was willing to do that to try to keep him from beating them. And
now, are they named after the TV show Power?
I don't think so, but it's interesting. There's both a Power and one of the characters in Power, the lead character, is nicknamed Ghost. There's also the Ghost Ballers. It could have been a Power Ghost final. We nearly had that, but both of those teams ended up losing in the semifinals. Anyway, Rashard Lewis scores the final two baskets with the game tied at 46. You play first to 50 in the Big Three rules, and the crowd really got into it. It was on its feet for those last couple of plays. A standing ovation for Rashard hitting the winning shot. And afterwards, you know, he talked about how it was really kind of an opportunity for him to have this moment he never had at the end of his Sonics career because of the fact that, you know, he left somewhat unexpectedly during the offseason. So it was, and then Gary Payton, obviously the coach of that team, Talked about how it felt like the 90s in there when the crowd got into it.
They were the team that the crowd rallied behind.
Oh, of course. Yeah, they were without question.
They were basically the Sonics. This is the closest that we've had.
For all intents and purposes, yes, they were. We also had a Sir Mix-a-Lot performance.
Oh, it really was like the 90s in there.
It really was. Reggie Evans played in the first game with his team, got a chance to catch up with him briefly afterwards, and he talked about how nice it was to come back to Seattle and, you know, much like Richard, all the memories that came back since neither of those guys had returned to Seattle since the Sonics moved, since they had last come through Key Arena as visitors to play against the Sonics. And, you know, I think just an overall vibe of everyone was excited and happy to have basketball back, men's pro basketball back in Seattle and in Key Arena for it today. So our loyal listener Jimmy had a question about this. He asked, do you think the turnout for the Big Three can help the city in its quest for the NBA? And I would say, quite frankly, no, if only just because of the fact that, look, nobody questions that Seattle is a good NBA market. That's never been the issue in terms of getting a team. It's just about the arena.
It just comes down to the arena.
And about the opportunity to get a team, having a team out there to get. So the arena situation, I think, is moving closer towards being resolved.
But turnout was good for the Big Three game?
So they just had the lower bowl open, and it was close to a sellout. I think they announced somewhere in the between 8,000 and 9,000 in terms of attendance. And, you know, I had heard that they were pleased with getting about 10,000 last week at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. So, you know, you think in a market like LA, a venue like Staples Center, you compare that to Seattle and Key Arena, to draw within 1,500 of what you'd get in LA, I think is certainly a positive result. So I'm optimistic that we can see the Big Three back in Seattle again next summer.
Maybe Ice Cube will we'll rethink his elation about the Lakers beating the Supersonics on that day.
Well, let's not go too far. Let's not go too far. All right, should we talk about the Seattle Sounders? A 2-1 win on Sunday versus Minnesota United, which undersells the drama.
One of the most thrilling 2-1 wins over the worst team in the MLS.
Yes. The Minnesota kind of had the better of play early. It seemed like the Sounders didn't really come out with the kind of focus you'd expect from this game, having beaten Minnesota 4-0 in Minneapolis earlier this season, just a couple of weeks ago. And we saw Minnesota grab the early goal to go up 1-0. Sounders equalized near halftime, and then Minnesota kind of dug in the second half, brought on a fifth defender, and tried to park the bus and get the 1 point on the road, which they've only scored 2 points all season. They've got two draws on the road. They have not won a game.
Kind of amazing to see an MLS team time-wasting starting in like the 63rd minute for a draw.
I think maybe even earlier than that. But, you know, you try to get points where you can as an expansion franchise that's, you know, struggling to get them. But sadly, they had draw snatched away from them in the final minute of the stoppage time.
On the last ball of the game.
Basically, yeah, a handball in the box. Basically, a save by a Minnesota defender using his hand. Clint Dempsey steps up to the spot, and even though the keeper guessed correctly that he was going to go to the keeper's left to Dempsey's right, still the placement and the power of the kick were good enough that he was able to score. Dempsey remains on fire, more than a goal per game since he's come back from the Gold Cup and winning the Gold Cup with the USMNT. The Sounders really did dominate this game in terms of expected goals,
yes,
even though it was close. So it was a deserved 3 points, I think, for them. Osvaldo Alonso played a full 90 for the first time since he was injured back on the 4th of July. So that was very encouraging to see him do that. We saw Christian Roldan get the start at left wing with Alonso pairing with Gustav Svensson in terms of defensive midfielders. And it was pretty much the preferred 11 for the Sounders at the start of this stretch, where they're going to be playing 3 matches in 8 days. On Wednesday, they travel up north on I-5 to face the Vancouver Whitecaps. And then on Sunday, it's the Portland Timbers who make the trip up I-5 as they at CenturyLink Field, a pair of Cascadia Cup derbies this week for the Sounders. And so it was interesting in that context that they basically went with the regular starting 11, what I guess will be the regular starting 11 now that you've got Alonso healthy in this first game, which suggests to me we're going to see a lot of squad rotation, some reserves get in the mix on Wednesday at Vancouver, as the Sounders really try to prioritize winning these two home matches, would be my guess. So that's that's why I think why it was so important for them to get these 3 points going into the start of this stretch where they're going to be so busy. But one regular we know they won't have on Wednesday or Sunday is Jovan Jones.
Kind of shocking news, right?
Yeah.
I mean, coming out of nowhere after this dramatic victory and the Sounders now sitting in first place, the news that Jovan Jones had returned home to Trinidad and Tobago to play in a friendly before more World Cup qualifying for Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can understand where he's coming from. This is an important stretch for Trinidad and Tobago as they try to pick up some points in World Cup qualifying. They've got matches coming up on September 1st and 5th. And Jones would have been free to join the team for those matches. It was just the friendly that he was not clear. You know, the Sounders were not obligated to.
It's kind of an unexcused absence.
Yeah, I mean, the report in the Seattle Times by Jeff Baker, who is getting a lot of play on this podcast, indicated that he did not.
He's the third Dalton brother. What if he likes burgers?
He did not inform Brian Schmetzer about his decision to travel back to Trinidad and Tobago until he'd already flown there.
Until he was there. He wasn't coming back at that point.
A little too late, yeah.
But so this, coupled with the fact that we know that he's going to FC Darmstadt. SV Darmstadt starting next season, I think kind of raises questions that maybe there's a chance that Jovan Jones doesn't return to the Sounders again, that we may have seen our last match of Jovan Jones.
I would be surprised if that were the case. You know, I think there probably will be some sort of disciplinary action from the fact that he didn't, you know, get the team's blessing before going and doing this or even give them a heads up about it. But, you know, the idea...
It's kind of funny that they want him to play as many matches as they can. It's like Allen Iverson being suspended for a big three game. It's like they're desperate to get any more matches from Jovan Jones. So if there was disciplinary action, what are you going to do? Suspend him?
I mean, you know, the thing is, it's more, I think, less about the games and more about just the protocol of getting permission beforehand.
Yes.
I think it's more about that. So the good news here, I'd be surprised if this really affects his long-term future, not long-term, but his future with the team for the remainder of the year. He's still such an important player, has been, you know, the team's leader in assists from the left back position. So even though Nuhu has been very exciting as a young prospect coming in, not only in place of Jovan Jones, but often pushing Jones into the midfield and playing at left back and, you know, using his pace to get up and down the pitch in much the same way that Jones does. And so it's good to know that he'll be able to step in the next couple of matches, but yes. I don't think you're ready to turn that position over to him full time.
But I mean, the Nuhu era basically begins right now.
Sort of. So the Whitecaps have been pretty average so far this season. Freddie Montero, the former Sounder, leads the team with 9 goals so far. The Timbers have been a little bit better than that, particularly at the offensive end of the pitch. Diego Valeri and Fernando Adi, the longtime Sounders killer Adi, both in the MLS top 6 and expected goals and assists per 90 minutes. But Adi has missed the last 2 matches with a hamstring injury. I think the expectation is that he will be back by Sunday. There was a thought that maybe he could have played last weekend when he missed his second match. Their keeper Jake Gleason also missed last Friday's match with a hamstring injury. And their backup Jeff Antonella, who'd really struggled early this season, they'd gotten kind of destroyed when he'd played previously when Gleason was out of the lineup, kept a clean sheet in their win over the New York Red Bulls.
Really? So, well, how about that?
We'll see whether he's still in goal as the Timbers come to Seattle.
Still probably would hope so.
Always an exciting matchup, and that one will be nationally televised again.
And what about the Storm this week?
Well, so after they made the coaching change, Gary Kloppenberg taking over for Jenny Busek, got the surprising win in his first game at Phoenix, then come home and pull out a pair of 1-point victories, beating the best team in the WNBA, the Minnesota Lynx, who were shorthanded without Lindsay Whalen and Rebecca Brunson, another starter, left during the first half and didn't return in that game. But still, the Storm able to take advantage and get a 62-61 win over Minnesota. And then on Friday night, kind of struggled against Kelsey Plum and the San Antonio Stars, were down 11 at one point in the fourth quarter, but rallied to get another 1-point win when Plum made a shot at the buzzer, or just before the buzzer, that looked like it was going to force overtime. But the Stars were down 3, and her foot turned out to be on the line. It was just a 2.
So. Just like the end of the BET Celebrity Game.
Yeah. Very similar. So a bummer for Kelsey Plum, but she performed much better in her second trip back to Seattle and continues to finish the season strong. And then on Sunday, the Storm go to Chicago to face the Sky, a team that really they're competing with for the final playoff spot, one of the final playoff spots, because now they've moved up into seventh, and beat them 103-66 on the road. An incredibly dominant performance. So
are Kloppenberg still undefeated as the head coach in Seattle?
It actually turned out I was wrong about that. Bob Kloppenberg was 2-2 when he was the interim coach in 92. So my stat was completely wrong. But Gary Kloppenberg is still undefeated. Okay. As the head coach in Seattle. So the Storm back in action on the road. They remain on the road Wednesday at Atlanta, a team with very slim hopes of qualifying for the playoffs. The Storm could basically end those with a victory on Wednesday night and then come home on Sunday to face Phoenix, a team that they've still got a chance of catching for the sixth seed in the WNBA playoffs, which would give them a home court advantage in the first single game, basically play-in round. I mean,
which is huge to have for a one-game playoffs.
Absolutely. So, you know, they've got a chance, and this is not quite a must-win to finish sixth, but it's close to it. It's certainly a very important one for them to win. So, that'll be a big one. Also, Breanna Stewart, based on that that performance in those three wins, named Western Conference Player of the Week.
And then some Husky news this week as we head toward, I think we're 10 days out right now, maybe 9 days when you're listening to this, before the first regular season game for the Huskies at Rutgers.
Yeah, it's hard to believe next week we're going to be doing a Husky game preview.
It's football's happening. So some news this week, the first AP poll coming out, Huskies ranked number 8 in the top 25. USC sitting at number 4, the highest ranked Pac-12 team. Stanford at 14, Wazoo at number 24.
And so the Huskies, of course, benefit in terms of schedule that they don't play USC this year during the regular season. And so that means, you know, they will not face a team ranked higher than them, although, of course, they do travel to face Stanford. So, you know, I think when you account for home field, the Cardinal probably the favorite in that one. The toughest game on the schedule.
And looking at this, I mean, my first instinct was that the Huskies were underranked, which is still my instinct. I mean, this is a team that they bring back basically their entire offense minus John Ross, right?
Yeah.
They went to the college football playoff last year. Why is a team like Clemson, who's losing their quarterback, ranked ahead of them?
I mean, they are facing significant losses on defense, and as confident as we are about Coach Pete's and the coaching staff's ability to coach up these young replacements, I can understand a certain skepticism is well warranted.
But then also my thought about it was, this doesn't matter.
It is true. I mean,
the rankings do matter, though. We learned last year that rankings can be the difference between being the 4 seed in the playoff and being the 3 seed.
But here's where the preseason ranking matters, is you have to be high enough to give yourself a chance to be in the mix. And at number 8, you are unquestionably high enough to do that.
Probably true.
So some recruiting business going on the football side. 4-star offensive lineman Nathaniel Kalepo from Rainier Beach commits as part of the 2019 class for the Huskies.
Huge!
I know how excited you are.
Mark your calendars.
I know how excited you are.
Let's probably see him play in 2021.
Yeah. I know how excited you are about any offensive lineman commit.
Very excited. Also a Danny Shelton cousin.
Yeah, so that's exciting to keep him as part of
the... Let me just say, this is one of the biggest signings for the 2019 class.
Unquestionably so. Also, in the basketball front, Husky basketball recruit Ed Chang transferring from his high school in Nebraska to play next year at Garfield under Brandon Roy. With
future Husky coach Brandon Roy.
So that was first reported by 206 Hoops. And later they had a tweet indicating that PJ Fuller, who played for Roy last year at Nathan Hale, is going to be transferring to Mater Dei High School in the LA area, which is interesting. Obviously, you hate to see PJ Fuller leave the area. It was great to have such a talented prospect, a guy who is a top rising junior outside of the Seattle area. But it's fascinating he's going to Mater Dei because, as my follower Ryan Curtis pointed out on Twitter as we were having a discussion of this with loyal listener Jimmy, this is Mike Hopkins' alma mater, and his head coach is still there.
Really?
Yeah.
Mike Hopkins' head coach is still at Mater Dei?
Yeah, he's been there 27 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so... You know, you have to figure there's some sort of connection or tie there that could work in the Huskies' favor.
Would rather have him at home, but...
And played for Brandon Roy. There's a stronger connection there. But yeah, Gary McKnight has been the head coach for 27 years.
It basically just means it's not the end of the world.
Exactly. It's not as bad as maybe it looks at first glance. But obviously plenty of time to go because he also is part of that coveted 2019 recruiting class. All right, with that covered, I think it's time, you know, your takes just haven't been hot enough. So,
wow.
We've decided again to go to the bullpen.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
All right, well, we're thrilled to welcome a professional to help us out with the Mariners hot takes today. Someone who has parlayed her successful career as a nose tackle for the Green Bay Packers into an equally successful career at ESPN. You can hear her on the Morning Roast radio show on Sundays, read her in ESPN the magazine on ESPN.com, and see her on various ESPN television programs. We're thrilled to have with us for the first time noted Seahawks fan Mina Kimes. Thanks for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here. Was that Kevin?
That was Kevin, yes.
You guys sound exactly alike. That's unreal. I thought for sure that was Tristan. You're actually brothers, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. We wouldn't sound like this if we weren't.
Why did one of you get called Kevin, and then why did the other one get a romance novel name? Like, what's the logic behind that? And Kevin, are you pissed? I'm turning the table. This is how professionals do it. I'm turning the tables on you with the question.
I don't know if you've ever specifically asked Mom that.
We also don't have the same last name anymore, which confuses
things
a little
confusing.
Bit more. Yes.
Yeah, your mom was like, you, son, are Tristan, the heir to the fortune, and you're Kevin.
I mean, I'm okay with it. I didn't need a romance novel name.
I'm pretty happy with it, though.
We work with what we get.
Wait, did you have one other question you were asking us about?
No, that was it. I think I know which one's Kevin, but I also don't know. That was a lie. It's okay. I think we'll make this work anyways.
All right, let's hear your Mariners hot takes.
Just any hot takes I have about the Mariners?
Yeah, let's just launch into it.
All right. Well, I was just telling you before the break, I'm a lifelong Mariners fan. The way I say that, it sounds like I'm at an AA meeting. Yes. Hi, my name is Mina Gimes, and I'm a lifelong Mariners fan. My hot take is that I pay for... Well, this isn't a hot take. It's a confession, but often those things blur in my career. I pay for like the whole MLB Mariners package every year. It's like $80, and I watch like 3 complete games, and... It's not that I'm not a fan because I follow the games like extremely closely and read the recaps and everything, but I also can't deal with the existential despair of like the day-to-day watching. I find it so stressful. So yeah, that wasn't a hot take at all. That was just a confession. All right, hot take. I think the Mariners are going to make it to the playoffs this season. That's a true hot take.
It feels like every other hot take we've had has been the Mariners are going to make it to the playoffs, and then the next hot take has been the Mariners are going to flame out spectacularly.
They go back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? They won yesterday, right? So that's good. Okay, other hot take. If they make it to a one-game playoff, Felix probably shouldn't pitch. That's kind of obvious right now, even though I think emotionally it's difficult to come to that conclusion.
Do you remember that? What is that movie called? Rookie of the Year or something? Where the kid breaks his arm and he's a really good pitcher. But then there's one out that he needs to get and he lobs the ball in.
Yes.
That's Felix in a one-game playoff.
Oh my God. He was the one, was it Little Big League, the one where Ken Griffey Jr. shuts him down?
Still the greatest Mariners playoff moment.
Yeah. do I need more hot takes?
I feel like that may be sufficient. I don't know if the Mariners are going to make the playoffs. It does qualify as a hot take. The current FanGraphs playoff odds at 18% for them right now.
That's pretty good.
It's double what it was a week ago.
For a Mariners fan, that's like, we're in. Oh, here's another confession. I got married in 2015, and there was a lot of hype going into the Mariners season, and I was like, for a second, maybe we shouldn't get married in October, which I hate myself so much for saying that. Oh, man, Mariners fandom.
We've now replaced the segment. It's now Mariners Confessions.
I like it.
It's really the same thing.
All right, well, we should get down to what we really wanted to talk about today, which is naturally the Seahawks and the state of the preseason.
Heck yeah.
So a 2013 win last Friday hosting Minnesota in the second preseason game that I think was overshadowed, marred by the loss of George Fant due to injury. Do you agree with that?
Yes, especially because literally less than 24 hours before, I recorded a podcast with Bill Barnwell in which I said George Fant was the breakout player that the season depended on. So I basically did this as a witch.
I'm going to assume Jonah Carey said something positive about George Fant and blame him for it.
I might have the same effect as Jonah. It is amazing to watch Seahawks Twitter go through like the 12 steps on this. I think we're now in the step where everyone's pretending George Fant was good.
George Fant is like a celebrity who died young.
Everybody's a fan. I loved him. Genie, you're free. Like, everybody's making memes about George Fant, how much he meant to us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a good point how quickly it went from like left tackle is this major question mark, fan is too raw, why is he starting there, to all of a sudden, wow, that was like the best part of the offensive line and now it's broken again. that was going to be like my hot take this week. Ben Baldwin on Twitter, our loyal listener, put together the five stages of grief in Seahawks tweet.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. I ripped off Ben's joke. This is funny because I make a big deal about how I won't follow him on Twitter, and I just shamelessly, or maybe great minds, I guess.
Yeah, I think he'll be pleased with this. So he initially was denial. He credited him with that. Maybe it'll be like Russ's knee injury and he'll come back in a few weeks, which turned out to be very untrue. It's an ACL and MCL injury that will require season-ending surgery.
I also thought that for a second. I've been through all these stages.
Then you represented Tristan anger with your tweet.
This is why the preseason should be banned. That Odell game last night made me think that even more.
Yeah. Well, it's just then if we started it late, I mean, whatever. It's a slippery slope. But yeah.
I mean, I'm in the camp of look, you got to play football at some point to prepare to play football. So I was in the bargaining stage, represented by Mike C, Peter, and Evan. With Fant wasn't that good anyway. Odhiambo will be fine. Actually, I was more at the Seahawks will move Luke Joeckel to left tackle, and they'll play Glowinski at left guard and Ibushi at right guard, and that'll be okay. And then it turns out that's wildly untrue as well.
They're not going to do that. Yeah, I went back right before the second game. I went back and watched the first drive and the starters, you know, just to kind of to look at the offensive line. And the whole left side looked okay. Joeckel in particular, I thought, looked quite good at guard, which is obviously what they've been saying. So then the question becomes, do you want a slightly diminished version of him at left tackle, potentially the best option, or do you want him to play well at left guard and have that position in the center basically shored up, right? So you got, you know, 2/5 of the line covered and secured. And I think that's a difficult kind of existential offensive line question. Obviously, it depends on how terrible the tackle candidates are. And now we've got all these wild cards in the mix.
Yeah, so Tom Cable did say on Tuesday that Ethan Posick will not be in the mix at left guard. Or left tackle. They're going to keep him at center and then maybe at right tackle. But the Seahawks acquiring Matt Tobin from the Philadelphia Eagles in a draft pick swap, give you up a 5th and getting a 7th back in that. And so he maybe is the one who's going to push Odhiambo at this point.
Their record with free agents is so bad. It's funny because, you know, it's such a small sample size of football. It's like, how can we predict whether a team is good with free agents? And one thing the Seahawks, and I always say this, have done incredibly well is fill them in on the defensive line, right? They've gotten old guys from various points of their careers and they've come in and played phenomenally. So some of their best signings, I think, in recent team history. But on the offensive line, they have yet to show that they can find an uncovered gem. I mean, anywhere, but frankly, but, you know, especially in free agency. So I really just have no confidence in Posick or Tyus Thompson was the other guy, right? Coming in and winning a starting role.
Yeah, I mean, I think Odhiambo, probably the way he played against Minnesota, it kind of made him look worse than he really is. I mean, we did see him play at left tackle in the playoffs against Atlanta, and it wasn't a disaster.
Yeah.
I kind of remember it being a disaster.
It wasn't good, but it wasn't a disaster. I mean, I think he'll settle in the more time he spends there.
Do you think the right side is secured as is? How do you think that shakes out?
Well, Bushi and Glowinski still seem very much up in the air, those two guys rotating series to series, basically, with the ones at this point. And my prediction maybe doesn't quite stand as much now that Ibushi will be cut if he doesn't win the starting job, but I still think there's a chance of it.
He's not. You're seriously still thinking there's a chance that Ibushi gets cut?
There's
no chance of that happening.
He's gotten way too much playing time to get
They like versatility in their backup linemen, so that's my thinking. But I do want to go on the record. Ben B. also dug up the take from the Pelton cast we recorded after Luke Joeckel signed, where I predicted he would not make it through the year on the roster, and I am walking back that take entirely. That was wrong. I disavow that take.
Oh my God. Ben B., jeez. It's like George R. R. Martin and his fans, where he's like writing the book for you. Just not the Ben B. Make him a brother.
Basically,
at least his voice sounds different.
He'll be on sometime soon, and he's basically the third Pelton brother. There are a lot of third Pelton brothers, but he's the official one.
I want to be
the third. But you're the third Pelton brother right now. But I think the main thing is that we just have to assume that Russell is going to be good enough this year that the line doesn't matter. And I was watching through the plays, every single passing play that they had in the Vikings preseason game. And there were free rushers coming almost every single play. But if Russell is at the 2015 level, he can get the ball out quick enough and make just enough plays that there can be a free rusher and he can deal with it. And I don't think we can expect the line to be a great offensive line at this point.
I mean, Russell Wilson has looked absolutely fantastic in this preseason at every turn. And I think of the first game on that third down scramble, the one where he's... Was it the third game, the one where he stepped up in the pocket and then scrambled? Yep. Or maybe it was...
Well, he had the scramble
game.
where he dropped short of the line on third down against the Chargers.
Okay, that would be, he stepped up in the pocket, as I recall, and went through the middle, right? In any case, he looks incredibly healthy and fantastic and confident. So I have no concerns about him. I don't know. Is the line worse than it was last year? Is it worse than it was 2 years? It's weird. I've been seeing a lot of, like, not a lot, but a few takes about how the line was good in 2013, which I don't know what, you know, version of history these people were living through. I guess everything is relative, but it wasn't good, you know? I wanted to bring this up. Speaking of Russell Wilson, did you guys see the QB tiers came out?
I did see
out?
That.
Yeah, I saw that one.
I saw that he was 10 and Derek Carr was 7. I didn't actually see what tier they were actually in, which is kind of the point of the piece.
And Luck was 6.
Oh, wow. That's like basically just designed to rile up Seahawks Twitter.
Yes. I know. I didn't see many CX Twitter people complaining about it, but maybe I was distracted by the Kyrie trade, and maybe they are melting down right now as we speak.
It's almost like, as you bring up these tiers, I think it was on Insider, which I don't have, so you're going to have to bring those up, but it's almost like we're spending so much time worrying about the line that we're not even paying attention to just how good Russell looks right now.
Interesting. And his weapons, man. I mean, I am on the Doug Baldwin is an elite wide receiver train, and I've been on it for a couple of years now. But he looked amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty comfortable with pretty much whoever they threw out there at this point. And we should probably transition here. By the way, Russell Wilson
Philip
was
Rivers, Matt Stafford.
Yeah, he was also in tier two. But
you've seen it.
I'm surprised Bortles wasn't ahead of him.
Bortles is weirdly high.
Somehow Tebow was ahead of him. That's weird.
It is ESPN after all.
Easy now. But we should transition.
At least we beat Eli Manning, or we, Russell Wilson, Jesus. Unlike the SI race.
We should transition here to talking about the wide receivers a little bit. So
to his new weapon.
Kayson Williams with an incredible one-handed catch, as well as a touchdown catch after Jermaine Kearse was unable to pull in a fade on the previous play. How excited are you?
Wait, you mean to tell me that Jermaine Kearse did not pull in a fade? Are you sure that happened, Kevin or Tristan, whoever said that? Are you positive? Let's rewind the tape, because that just seems very unlikely.
Look, note that Kevin's very sad right now.
I still think Jermaine Kearse is going to make the team.
At 4 or 5. Is he the 4th or the 5th receiver, though?
Yeah, Kevin? I don't know.
Listen to your heart and be honest.
I mean, here's the thing is the Seahawks coaching staff has not necessarily evaluated Jermaine Kearse the same way as fans have, which is why he was still the starting wide receiver as late as like week 12 last year and was the number 3 even after that.
I mean, Wilson also likes Jermaine Kearse. That's the thing. We always, you know, right? He clearly, but Wilson seemed to like throwing to Kayson. I mean, part of the reason I'm now confident that Kayson makes this team is I think nobody has any confidence at all in Paul Richardson's ability to not disappear,
right?
Like disintegrate into dust in any given game. And you know, I think Kayson has a lot of the same capabilities. I mean, I'm Kayson Crew is in full force, guys.
Yeah,
I consider myself
the first person
on Twitter to ever hashtag Kayson Crew. So that's what makes you the charter member.
Mm-hmm. Two Ks, get it right.
I feel like you're forcing people by doing the Kayson Crew, you're forcing them to choose between Kayson and Kearse. And as I was discussing on Twitter over the weekend with our mutual friend, Natalie Weiner, we shouldn't have to choose between the two of them. There's room in my heart, certainly, for both Kayson Williams and Jermaine Kearse and any other former Husky wide receivers the Seahawks want to bring in.
Soft. So you think they take 5, by the way, or 6? Who's the 6?
Are we
I don't know exactly where the math is going, but Darbo is definitely in there.
I think
as much as they invested in him, okay. Unless this concussion is serious enough that he ends up on IR.
Wait, so let's go through the wide receivers.
But he was back at practice yesterday, so that's not possible.
Baldwin, Lockett, Richardson,
Curse,
Casey. Just say it,
Tanner
Kaysen.
McAvoy.
No, it feels good there.
No, I'm saying Tanner McAvoy.
Oh,
out.
McAvoy is
that's what the real competition seems to be. Yeah. Is you've got two spots and you've got Darbo.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Kaysen and Tanner McAvoy, and to me, T-Mac's the one who's out.
Yeah, T-Mac versus Darbo, who knows, right? I mean, have we seen enough of either this preseason to really make an
just
educated...
as a third round pick, I can't see them possibly getting rid of Amara Darbo.
Yeah, you're probably right. McAvoy's been so clutch though in so many moments, but he's not a huge special teams contributor either.
And that's what I'm saying. I feel like whatever combination they threw out there, I feel pretty comfortable with, including the post.
Yeah. No, I really like this receiving group, man. I mean, just laying, like describing all of them, it makes me really excited. The most excited I think I've been in a few years.
What about at running back? Are you on team Chris Carson?
Yeah, I mean, I have eyes and a beating heart, so of course I'm on team Carson. Okay, let's do the running back group. So how many? They carried five last year.
That sounds right. Yeah, because Collins would have been the four, Procise the three.
Michael and Rawls.
Yes. Okay, so Lacey, Rawls, Procise is 1 through 3. And then we get into, if they carry five, you've got Carson, Collins, Davis, and McKissick. That's four guys competing for two spots. And that's very competitive.
I mean, the return situation, I think, is going to determine a lot of this over the next 2 weeks. If, the Seahawks feel comfortable with Lockett returning kicks, then that reduces the need to keep McKissick a lot.
Yeah. No. Do you want Lockett returning kicks? I kind of like the idea of McKissick doing it.
I think I might still.
No.
I don't know. I need to see him do it this year.
The thing about McKissick...
It's so we talk dynamite, about first... but... I mean, there's also Earl Thomas.
No.
Richard Sherman, returning punts. But the thing about McKissick is the versatility, returning kicks, running back, and wide receiver.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's also a receiver. That's true. Yeah, I mean, I think I was surprised by how much they ran Collins in the last game. I think they're really trying to get a feel for that. And then, of course, Davis had that great end around, from like the 5 or the 10. But Chris Carson, I mean, his burst on that goal line touchdown, like I thought, oh man, they're playing a fullback because he just like freaking trucked like five guys, and they were not playing fullback. He just straight trucked them. He wasn't even running behind like a pulling guard. He is so powerful and explosive, and it just seems like such an integral component.
And one of my theories
offense.
Is that people probably pay too much attention to performance in preseason and not enough to just who's running where. So the fact that Carson was playing as much as he was with the ones with Thomas Rawls out on Friday night, I think was a key sign in his favor.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as Rawls versus Lacey, I don't know. I mean, it seems like they want it to be Rawls, but I don't think either has distinguished themselves above the other at this point.
I enjoyed Bill Barnwell's take on the season preview podcast you guys did, which everyone should check out on the Bill Barnwell Show, that CJ Procise would be the number one back by the end of the year. I just don't feel like the Seahawks are looking at it that way.
I was going to give the take that Chris Carson would be the number one back by the end of the year.
That is a hot take.
Wow, that's a true hot take. You saw today the quote from noted Seahawks fan favorite Tom Cable, who was asked about Procise's dependability, if he was concerned, and he said, "I think we all are." So that's about as spicy as it gets. What's wrong with him? It says he had tightness during pregame warm-ups. Like, what's going on? Are we going to actually see him?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a little disconcerting. I mean, probably just being overly cautious in the preseason.
There's a sigh. It's a Mina sigh.
He's so great. Like, those few games that he played in were just magic. So I would love for Bill to be right. I don't know how to... I said this on, I think, Bill's show, too. I just hate labeling guys as injury-prone in general. It feels so pat. And we're not doctors, but it is concerning.
That is definitely something we have railed against on the Pelton cast. I just think the other thing,
oh, really?
Though, is I think Pete Carroll values so much the idea of the power run game that he's really going to give Lacey and Rawls every opportunity to win that starting job.
Yeah. That's the other thing about Procise is he symbolizes a diversification of the offense that's really exciting, right? I don't know. I hope he plays.
I still think he'll be key part of the offense as a third down back and mixed in on the first two downs. I just don't see them seeing him as the primary back.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that is the case either.
Yeah. Let's talk about maybe the most exciting part of Friday's game, which is Blair Walsh taunting the Vikings sidelines after making a pair of field goals in the second half of this game. How much fun was that to watch?
I'm thinking about getting a Blair Walsh jersey. He is my new favorite player. It was just also like such a welcome to the Seahawks moment, right? Because you're like, oh, right, this is why the team hates us. And it was such a reaffirmation of identity, especially I saw on Twitter. I didn't see this, but somebody tweeted that Richard Sherman joined him. And I was just like, oh, overcome with emotion and happiness when I saw that. Also, Richard Sherman is so lit during preseason games. Can we talk about every other, and it doesn't feel like it's for a show. He is so overly amped for every little thing that happens. I think, gosh, every time Shaq Griffin touched a dude, he lost his, we should talk about Shaq Griffin. But anyways, I am extremely here for it. I wanted to see with Walsh, he obviously went, I think, 8 for 8 or something the first week or the first couple weeks. And I wanted to see what happened after he missed. Because that, to me, so he missed, he bounced that kick. And I was like, okay. Well, I like that I was in the middle, first of all. If you're going to miss that way. And then he came back and just nailed it. And I don't know. I'm super excited about that signing. Because that could be, with a team this good, that's the kind of thing that could really tank a season. So his looking promising is such an underrated aspect of this offseason if it works out.
And we've never seen, I always wondered why people love Steven Hauschka so much. We've never seen Steven Hauschka taunt his former team during a preseason game.
Well, maybe if the Bills had been on the schedule.
Or any kicker. I saw him. I was at Bills camp. Hauschka is so tall.
Wait, really?
I think he's 6'4". He walked by and I was like, oh my God.
It was Condotta who wrote about that the other day, the contrast between Hauschka and Walsh. And Walsh is 5'9" and it's the second shortest player on the team.
Oh yeah. Walsh looks like Frodo. He looks like he lives in a forest with the other elves, and I love it. I'm tying myself into getting that jersey.
Last week Ice Cube walked by us. Ice Cube is very little.
Yeah, they usually are. That's why I was so surprised about Hauschka. They're usually smaller in real life. Just
rappers and kickers.
Just anyone famous is small in real life.
So famous, Steven Hauschka can't walk anywhere without getting mobbed. All right, last week's news, which we sort of touched on a little bit, but had not become finalized by the time we recorded last week, the Seahawks signing Tremaine Brock, and really very few people better qualified to discuss this than you, Mina, in terms of thinking about how NFL teams should handle domestic violence and deal with those allegations and then suspensions and all that sort of thing. Talk us through your reaction to this, and then specifically kind of this notion that the Seahawks had gone above and beyond other teams in investigating the situation, but then not really telling us anything about what that investigation actually entailed.
So I have written a little bit about my process and thinking about domestic violence in the NFL and punishment in particular, and how we talk about it, and because it's very difficult for me. And I suppose when I say it's difficult because I feel, I think like a lot of fans and writers and just general observers in the NFL do, general frustration and anger, but not, I'm not always quite sure who to direct that at, right? Because I'm also, I've written about this, I'm uncomfortable with the idea that there shouldn't be second chances. And I'm also uncomfortable with the idea that there should be zero tolerance punishment policies, because I think they can work against, they can disincentivize victims from stepping forward. And we've seen that outside of the NFL, outside of sports with domestic violence. And in many cases, as with the Brock case, the accusers or alleged victims or victor, however it shakes out legally, decide not to testify. Or, and a lot of times, that's just very common with domestic violence. And as a result, we're put in the place where we don't really have a conclusive account of what happened. So what do we say? Okay, this person wasn't charged. Should they never play in the NFL? Should they apologize and play in the NFL? What does it mean to deserve a spot in the NFL roster? And I don't think any of those questions have easy answers, certainly not universal ones. So going to the question of, well, what makes me angry? And there's a few things that make me angry with this situation. One of which was John Schneider coming out a few years ago and saying that they would never sign a player with this in his past.
Yep.
That was stupid. I've said that, many times. You don't put out red lines because teams don't follow them. I'm sorry. The Seahawks aren't unique in this, by the way. None of these teams are, right? We've seen it just across the NFL. So you're not special, and these red lines are so hard to enforce, and you're not going to do it. So don't lay them out, because it sets up a terrible situation. The second thing that frustrates me about this is when teams suggest that they've investigated it and they've come to some sort of conclusion. One, because we have no idea what they're actually investigating. Are they looking for innocence? Are they looking for forgiveness or acceptance or an admission of guilt? What are they looking for? We have no idea. So they're trying, it feels to me always like, and again, this is not certainly not exclusive to the Seahawks, what they're trying to do is just make it go away through vague statements and a lack of transparency that I find more frustrating than anything else, you know, to begin with. So I don't think it was handled well. I'll just say that. I don't think the Frank Clark case was handled well either. And I find that really disappointing because it's the organization that I root for and I pay a lot of attention to. And we've just been talking about backup running backs on the practice squad who we'll forget in 5 years. So it's frustrating to me when this organization or any organization in the NFL, I think, doesn't live up to the standards that they set up. Sorry, that was a monologue.
Well, I also think it's frustrating because of the fact that they do handle a lot of other situations so well. And I think that, you know, that's something we like about the Seahawks organization, yeah, above and beyond their success on the field.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's frustrating. It just feels dishonest. And I something I've also said before, I just wish teams, Seahawks in this case, would come out and say, we're not the law. We don't know what happened, but we know this guy is committed to being a good person. He said that, and we're going to help him do that. And if we don't, we screwed up and we'll admit it. And I would just prefer that over anything.
Makes a lot of sense. Another situation that I think they have handled much better is Michael Bennett sitting for the national anthem. And then after talking last week about how important it would be for white teammates and other white players throughout the league to kind of support the cause, didn't have anyone join him, but did have Justin Britt come over and put his hand on his shoulder and then afterwards talk about how he wanted to show support for Bennett and learn more about this issue. So what did you read into that situation? What did you take from that?
Justin Britt, who I saw, I can't remember which reporter, it was like a national reporter, I think, identify as the Seahawks' best white player. I don't know why that just cracked me up. I was like, interesting.
Kicker jersey thing. It felt like for a period of time, if you had the Stephen Hauschka or John Ryan jersey, like, you were kind of going out of your way.
John Ryan.
Which is funny because our cousin's husband does. And he's not actually white. So it's weird that he was trying to. I don't think he was trying to do that.
I know a guy who has a John Ryan jersey, but his name is John Ryan.
That's acceptable.
Also, that's why.
Totally.
He owns
totally
it.
Understandable.
Good reason. Yes.
So the Seahawks' best white player.
Yeah, I thought they handled it well. The Seahawks' best white, I thought they handled it well. I really liked Britt's statement. Not that it matters whether I like it. You know, it's obviously his. But what I liked about it was just, you know, these protests are about very specific issues, inequality, issues that we're talking about a lot right now because of what's in the news. You know, it started with inequality and inequity in policing and has been somewhat broadened. And I like that Britt's statement didn't take away from that. It wasn't like, oh, we're just, you know, this is about unity and unity is great. No, he specifically referenced the fact that Michael Bennett was protesting something specific that he wants to learn about. And I think, you know, that's what allyship is, right? So I was pleased. By the way, just to take it to football, I was also pleased and shocked that they extended Britt and at the price they did, which I guess lessened my shock, but I was still pleased.
Do you think there was any chance that the fact that he had just signed this extension made him more comfortable, like, joining Bennett?
That's a great question.
I mean, I think it's probably a coincidence, but it is interesting because there is such a sense that the reason a lot of NFL players don't protest is because of the fear for their roster spots, you know, the Colin Kaepernick effect.
Yes, what's happened to Colin Kaepernick. They've been made to fear for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's really interesting. I think knowing this team, and I think all the players are pretty comfortable, right, speaking their minds, so maybe less so than other teams. I will say one thing that's been really interesting to me is the absence of individualized backlash. Somebody asked me, well, you know, we saw the Browns protest last night. It was a bunch of players, including a white player, yelling for the first time. Yeah. And someone asked me, well, do you think that this will make it easier for Colin Kaepernick to come back? And I said, no, because I think he has individually become so famous. Now it just feels more like a broader wave of sorts that people are interpreting in different ways. But I think his name is so stigmatized, you know, in some ways that it's just different at this point.
And I mean, I think it's unlikely that the president is going to tweet about Browns tight end Seth Devolve.
Or Justin,
you know, one other note that I saw come up on Twitter last week is that the discussions of, like, white supporters and white allies have kind of ignored Megan Rapinoe, who kneeled for the anthem while playing for the Seattle Reign last year. And I think maybe, I don't know if she knelt while she was playing for the USWNT as well, but she was certainly right there in the midst of the Kaepernick, you know, situation.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's hard because I think people are talking about this in the context of the NFL. So you could say that's inadvertently sexist, or there's some subtext to the fact that she's not considered, but I do feel like it is pretty contained.
The amount of eyeballs that are on an NFL game is so different than a Seattle Reign game.
Yeah, completely. Although, you know, she came under pressure as well, as I recall, from U.S. soccer. Megan Rapinoe's a real one, man. I really like her. But yeah, that's a good point. I have no idea how this is going to change over the season, but it doesn't appear to be going
away. I think
away
basically what it means is the impact of every single individual player doing it, kneeling for the anthem, becomes less and less and less. Especially when you have this Browns with a whole circle of players kneeling on Monday Night Football. All of a sudden, maybe it's not just Michael Bennett. Maybe it's a group of players.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's something that Kaepernick dealt with, that Malcolm Jenkins has spoken about, that NBA players have spoken about, which is that if the point of a protest is to call attention to an issue, attention being the operative word, you know, and what happens when it loses its impact? How do you evolve? How do you change in a way that continues to keep people talking about it? Because I think so often people are saying, well, then you have to do action. Yes. You have to donate. Well, these guys do that. Like, that irritates me. Colin Kaepernick in particular has been extremely active in that area. Completely, yes. Michael Bennett's been hugely involved. So I think it's just these optics matter a lot. The optics of a white player kneeling matters. The optics of Justin Britt and Michael Bennett, that matters. So I think optics are going to play an interesting role in the
continued evolution. Yeah, I mean, it makes it feel a little less like an us versus them issue, I guess is what I would say about it. So
yeah, completely. That's true. Yeah, it normalizes a bit.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, you had a piece on E60 on SportsCenter a couple weeks ago featuring Cam Chancellor. And I wondered if you had any interesting stories that kind of got left on the cutting room floor there that you can share with us.
Ooh, Cam is great. He's very straightforward and he is unique on that team. And we talked a little bit about that story came out, or I was in Norfolk about the time that Seth Wickersham's piece on the Seahawks came out, which Cam had not read, and I believe him, but we talked a little bit about it, and the way he was talking about it with me, it was so obvious that he is the anti-drama on that team, the locus of calm and peace, and in a way that made me less surprised when they extended him, which I didn't think was going to happen. I don't think his leadership role in that locker room can be underestimated. Another thing that him and, you know, the piece kind of addressed the fact that he has been I don't want to say game changer, that's a little bit strong, but has sort of redefined the strong safety position in the NFL. You know, one thing we've heard a lot of, Keanu Neal, right? Someone he's taken under his wing. This, you know, the NFL teams are starting to say, well, I want a Cam Chancellor. Obviously, Atlanta just does everything that Seattle does, but it's like, if you want to be us so bad, why don't you just marry us?
Dramatic.
But, oh my gosh. I appreciate that so much, though. Don't you guys, like, doesn't that make it easier just to live?
Not at all.
Like, I think that out.
Yeah, I mean, the opposite.
Like, it's a lot happier if the Patriots
lost. It's so
The story is this preseason about how the Falcons deal with it, and it's, like, bringing back a lot of memories.
Oh, yeah. You feel it's, like, triggering. Okay, interesting. Because I feel like it's such a more shameful loss that somehow that shame has been sloughed off a little bit. Cam also mentioned that he had... So let's
remember when they didn't run the ball? Wait, hold on.
Did they have thrown? I know. Yeah, I know. It was the right call to throw. Anyways, but Cam also mentioned to me that he had been in touch with OB Melifau. I don't know if I'm saying his name right, but who, you know, a lot of Seahawks fans wanted
Five
for
Sigma.
Our team, which I didn't really agree with. But there you go. That's why. But I just love the fact that he reaches out to every big safety who's drafted. It's like, I find that so adorable. In Keanu Neal, I think, gosh, I can't remember who told me this, was kind of surprised. He was like, is this really Cam Chancellor? We called him. I think it's just so neat that he's forming this like big dude club in the NFL and reaches out to them and offers to train with them. I just think it's really cool.
Well, and I think when we talked about this, Richard Sherman's outspoken. Earl Thomas is a little bit quieter. But I think of Cam Chancellor as the heart of the Legion of Boom. And that's kind of what you're talking about, Mina. And we've seen this over and over and over again. Everybody rallies around Cam more than any other player, I feel.
Yeah, I think that's true. I just remember one other story he told me. So him and Earl Thomas were roommates during rookie camp. Or when was Cam drafted?
Yep.
Same draft. They're roommates. And I know, gosh. And they're both really quiet. You know, Earl's super, they're very different. Earl is insane and intense and amazing and emotional. And oh, that was another thing. I asked Cam about his tweet, you know, the infamous I'm gonna retire tweet that sent us all into like I probably aged 5 years in that moment. But when I asked Cam about that, he was laughing at the idea that any of us took it seriously. He was like, "You not know Earl?" Like, he's just like, he's so emotional, and you know, like he just was like, nobody thought that he was gonna retire. But anyways, he mentioned at their rookie camp, so they're both really quiet and they're roommates, and they were like sitting down, kind of hanging out. And after a few hours, Cam's like, all right, so like one of us has to talk, right? Because they had just been silent for hours sitting in this room. And I just love that. And now they're, you know, besties.
I feel like I can empathize with that. All right, well, everyone should check out.
Who's the Earl and who's the Cam?
He's the Earl. Kevin is the Earl. Would you agree with that?
I don't know. You're pretty emotional sometimes.
You're more technically proficient.
Wow. Oh, you're looking more for playing style?
And also, I think you're definitely the Earl in almost every way.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, they're Sherman. Third Belton brother right there.
There we go. Now we just need to find our Shaquille Griffin.
Ben B's Shaq Griffin.
Yeah.
There's our Legion of Boom, the Belton cast Legion of Boom.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mina, for taking the time. We're glad we could make this happen. Have wanted to do this for a long time, and look forward to having you back in the future, assuming you're willing to do it again.
No problem. Absolutely. I'm honored. I've been, you don't have to, you being nice to me, I've been begging to get on this podcast, shamelessly begging. It's the one property I can't get on. So this has been,
It really goes in order of prestige. It goes around the horn and then it goes Pelton cast. I've said that for a long time.
I'd reverse it.
Levitard's in there somewhere. Yeah. Yeah. Well, glad to make your wish come true here.
All right. Well, thank you, Mina. And thank you for listening.
Thanks.